This is The Unseen. And I'm your host, Mike Cleland. This week I talk with young Canadian filmmaker Brad Abrahams. His recent documentary, Love and Saucers, came out a bit over a year ago, and I loved it. And I guess for a podcast like this, it might be more appropriate to do an interview that lines up with the premiere of a movie, but this movie is really quite good, and it's very easily accessible online to watch. The film is about a man named David Huggins, who has painted his memories of his contact experiences, and a few of these paintings are included in the show notes for reference. Now, these images and his story are quite arresting, and I give a heads up to the listener, there is a very powerful sexual element in these paintings and in David's story. Now, right at the very beginning of our interview, Brad said something that caught me a little off guard. It happened right in the very first few seconds. And what many listeners may not know is that beyond my OWL books, I've also published a book on ultralight backpacking. And this came up. It was a little bit of a surprise for me, and it's a little bit funny. I thought about editing it out, but I kept it in. It actually would have been difficult to snip out where it was in the talk, so I kept it in. This was a wonderful interview, and it was recorded in June of 2019. Please enjoy. Brad, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Of course, and I'm a fan of your writing, so this is a pleasure.
What do you know of my writing?
Well, I know about your theme of the owls, and even before the UFO world, I used to read your ultralight backpacking.
Oh my goodness.
Articles.
There's a very rare sub. I'm interrupting here, and then we're going to get sidetracked a little bit, but there is a very narrow crossover between the two. I think there's probably five people in the whole world that have crossed over, and somehow now I've met the fifth one. So thank you. Thank you.
Of course.
Hey, and I will also say I'm a big fan of your film. You directed a documentary called Love and Saucers, and it deals with a person I know. I actually have never met David. David Huggins and I talked on the phone a lot starting around 2008 or so. And for the next few years, he would call me often and we would talk, you know, once a month or so. And we would have these long, powerful conversations. And do you remember how we met?
No.
Here's how we met. So what happened is I was online. I was looking at there was a little teaser reel. I think it showed up on Facebook or something. And it was like a trailer for your movie, Love and Saucers, about David Huggins. Now, we'll get into who he is in a moment here. But he is a very, I don't think I'm saying anything you don't know. He is a very gentle soul. He's had UFO contact experiences, and they are extremely strange. And they would be very easy to exploit. So when I saw you were making a documentary, I wrote an email that said, you know, don't you dare do a mean-spirited documentary about David, or I'm going to find you. And I rewrote it and said it and said basically the same thing in a much more polite way, because I was genuinely like, oh, crap, this could be disastrous. So I sent you a letter and basically said, don't you dare exploit David Huggins. And you sent back a very thoughtful letter saying you would do nothing of the sort. I don't know how long it was, a year or so later, the documentary came out, and I was so taken and so relieved. I think if there was a one-word description for this documentary, I guess it would be compassionate. It's a very loving portrait of this gentle soul.
Thank you. Yeah, and I actually do remember the exchange now, and I think partly it's because you saw like a trailer or a teaser. And often, even for documentaries that are very respectful, the trailers tend to be a little more sensational or a lot more sensational than the actual movie. And I understand if that, because of course the trailer is going to start off with him losing his virginity to an extraterrestrial, which is the most sort of wild claim, or one of them.
Okay, here, let's just go right into the movie. So that is, I think, I just watched it again last night. That is the very first line. Well, within the very first 20 seconds of the movie, David says that about himself. So go ahead and just fill everyone in on the movie itself.
Yeah, so that's how the movie starts. I wanted to start with sort of the most out there statement in the film. And then sort of then my challenge would be to work backwards and sort of prove to the viewer this guy is not crazy. You don't have to necessarily believe exactly word for word what he's saying, but you have to at least acknowledge that he's a normal, down to earth, sort of a sweet and respected guy. And so when you realize that and then pair it with these very outlandish claims that he's saying, that's the sort of cognitive dissonance that I wanted to create and really have people then start to question their own positions on these things. So stepping back a little bit, so the film is about the experiences and the life of this man, David Huggins, who's now, I think, 76 years old. And starting at the age of 9, he had encounters with what can be described as extraterrestrials. He doesn't necessarily go that far, just otherworldly beings that have visited him for decades since the age of 9. And when he turned 17, those visits turned sexual. And he states that he did lose his virginity at 17 to one of the recurring extraterrestrial beings, and then had a lot of other sort of erotic encounters with them. They weren't the only type of encounters, but for some decades, they were the most apparent. And he, as a way to sort of cope with these experiences, he began to paint them. He was trained a little bit as a painter at the Art Students League in New York. And so he knows how to paint with oils. And he's now done, I don't know, maybe 200 of these sort of amazing, surreal, off-putting paintings of his chronicles with these beings.
Hey, I will add that I've talked with him at length, and he doesn't want to sell those paintings. He's holding on to those. He loves those paintings. He's talked to me at length about this.
We have I've helped him sell some now. So he
because I think of this, like, I don't want to say he's clinging to these, but I mean he definitely pours his heart out into these.
Yeah, and one interesting note is that of the ones he sold, he's repainting them just so he still has them, because for him they're memories. It's like his records of these experiences. So, and he was very reticent at first to sell the paintings. I encouraged him. I didn't push him, but just, you know, said there's a lot of people interested in your work. And you know, he's on a pension. He works like once a week part-time at this deli. He can definitely use some extra money. So I'm really glad that people showed the interest and started buying them.
And so the sort of core of this movie, the core of the whole thing, is David sitting in his studio. He holds up a painting and he talks about it. There's a little bit of cross editing with some stock footage of, let's say, his youth in Georgia, and there's some rural images, and then his time in New York City, and there's some images of New York City, probably from the early 1960s and such. But I'm going to compliment you. I am sort of the era where I am so annoyed by what would be modern documentary filmmaking with all the cuts and zaps and edits and sound effects. And I just, in essence, I'm giving you a little, like a hug here for creating something that treated me, the viewer, as an adult. And I am so grateful.
Yeah. And that was, you know, very consciously done also just to present the story in a sober way. The story itself is for most people so bizarre that to then also add, you know, very postmodern filmmaking and editing techniques to that would have, I think, pushed it over the edge. And I think you see that, you know, way too much already with paranormal type subject matter.
Absolutely. Yeah. So at the core of the movie, there's David, and he goes step by step talking about his encounters beginning as a small boy, and he holds up paintings. And these paintings are, we'll include some in the show notes. And on one level, you could say, like, you could take a step back, and he's not like a great artist in the skill, let's say. But there's a few images that I actually sent you a handful of them, probably sent you three or four, that have such a powerful, I mean, they're as powerful as anything I've ever seen. I mean, the actual technique of the painting is there's technicians out there, or technical painters, that could do a more tight, perfect job of capturing an image. But I will say this man does a powerful, beautiful job of capturing a mood.
Yes, and it's one of the many things that drew me to the film, or to make the film, was seeing. So I heard his story before I saw the images, and his story was enough, you know, to get me part of the way there. But once I saw the images themselves, they weren't really available online. I had to order Farah's book of them. I really found them cinematic. Like, you just look at one of those frames and they tell a whole story. And yeah, there's mood, there's atmosphere, there's tension. I don't know how much all of that was his intention outright, but he's just a natural at capturing that. And it lays more credence to him having experienced something, just because they really feel like memories.
Yes. They feel like, you know what they feel like? They feel like dream memories in a way. They feel like, you know, I mean, obviously he's looking back, it's his own memories, and whether he's romanticized them, in a way, I guess he has, because I've never heard a man say anything bad about his experiences. And I mean, for instance, there's one image of a young David. He looks like he's a boy of about 10, being floated upwards. I sent this to you. And he's surrounded by, it looks like, five or so aliens, these kind of gray, short beings in these blue jumpsuits. And there's the sense of floating is palpable. There's what seems to be a glowing saucer-shaped ship above them. And then looking down, you can see the roof of what either looks like his home or his barn. And that image alone is so arresting to me. It captures the sensation of floating. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, and his title for that painting is Floating Up. And it's amazing. Like, in the film, you can see it to some extent, all the close-ups of that painting, but it's actually a very large painting, and he gave it to me.
Oh my word!
So I have it. Yeah,
I almost want to cry right now. Keep going.
Yeah. I had it on our, you know, above the little my office / guest room to creep out anyone who stayed over. But yeah, it's very big, and if you look at it up close, there's like, especially his face, there's so much emotion in there. It's like fear, but wonder. The way that they're all sort of grabbing his limbs, it's one of the more powerful, unsettling, I think, as well, because I think we can imagine what it must have felt like or ourselves in that situation at like 9 years old, 8 or 9.
Yes, it's unsettling. And then as he passes from boyhood into adulthood, then the sexual content comes in. Now, I've had long, long conversations with him, and I can't remember exactly, but I don't think the sex stuff ever came up at all during our conversations. It might have, but I just simply don't remember. What I do remember very clearly was his emotional feelings of love for this one woman being, this tall, gray being named Crescent. And that was, he was much more interested talking about his emotional longing for this woman.
Yeah, and he, you know, I pressed him on it, and he, you know, went as far to say that he felt love for her. He said he didn't know if she felt the same back to him. He hoped so. But yeah, he, you know, considered that he was in a relationship with her for the period that it was happening. And she was definitely the most frequent visitor. She wasn't the only one that he had sexual experiences with. There were a few other of the women. But she was... yeah, definitely the most frequent and welcomed of them all.
And so, I mean, you're just heads up, you are speaking to a very sophisticated listening audience. The audience
yes.
here at Whitley Strieber's site. So, I mean, anyone listening on this site will be very well aware of there's a sexual thread that runs through the UFO contact experience. Not everyone, obviously. And there's certainly the thread of what would be the term that's often used as hybridization or hybrids, but certainly the what seems like some sort of genetic program is in play, and people are often presented with babies, or women are have memories of lost pregnancies, and oftentimes accompanied with you know, vivid memories of a fetus being taken. And I've talked to a number of women like this, very tough, traumatic stuff. And it's yet his story. And I've talked to other women too, that feel this longing and this love for these children that they've never met.
Yeah. He misses them. He talks about them like they're his own children, would like to see them again. But it's just not, you know, not a decision of his to make.
I hate to do this, but I need to interrupt right now, and we are going to take a short commercial break. For non-members, you'll hear some commercials, but for members, we'll be right back.
A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. Over the next few months, he'll be reading from it for subscribers prior to publication. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A New World, Unforgettable.
Join our subscriber section today. Click on the subscribe tab on unknowncountry.com to place your order.
I've been a subscriber to Unknown Country from almost the beginning. I get information there I can get nowhere else on the web.
This is Whitley Strieber. Go to Unknown Country and click on the subscribe tab. Join us. You owe it to yourself.
We are back with Brad Abrahams, and we are talking about his documentary from the end of 2017, a documentary called Love and Saucers. Brad, just before the break, we were talking about this emotional content that is part of David's, I guess it's just part of his, who he is. And I said it before, and I'm going to say it again. Like, this is a very gentle, soft-spoken man. And his, like, you watch the first few minutes of the film, and you're like, this seems like this, you know, 70-year-old man kind of walking around his apartment a little bit, just talking to the camera. And it doesn't take long before, I mean, I was just taken in. I would almost say the gentleness of his voice is almost hypnotic. Like, I've spoken to him at length, so I can't separate myself from knowing him. But for an outsider, I have to think that everyone would recognize that in who this man is, who David Huggins is.
Yeah, and that's what I experienced on the film festival circuit. We got a different kind of audience, because it's sort of the film festival going audience. They're not necessarily like UFO fans. Were interested in that, more so they would go to the film just because it sounds interesting and weird. And so in the Q&As afterwards, I often would hear from people that they went into the film just thinking they would see something, you know, a portrayal of just this crazy or insane guy talking about his UFO experiences, and they'd be laughing the whole time. But very quickly and definitely by the end, they don't know what to think at all anymore, because he obviously isn't crazy. And, you know, they're sort of had people re-examining their beliefs and sort of their level of judgment after actually hearing him speak and getting to know him. I think no one can really deny that. It's just sort of a fact of his character.
Oh, I agree. He's got a wonderful presence. He's got a wonderful presence on camera and a wonderful voice. This is sort of just a lilt of a southern drawl from his childhood in Georgia. You mentioned earlier Farah's book. Now, there's a researcher, her name is Farah Yerdoza. I think I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. And I think it would have been around 2008 or 2009, she came out with a book called Love in an Alien Purgatory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I remember David did not like the name of the book. He said, I just wish it would have been called The Art of David Huggins, which is fair. But what he did think was wonderful about the book, and he said, you know, that when you open the book up, it's a slim little coffee table book. It's an art book with beautiful color images. And Farah interviewed David, and you can hear his words, or you can read his words, and he describes each of these paintings, you know, one by one. So it's a marvelous, very visual, like there's a lot of books out about experiencers, right? They're firsthand experiences, people who've had UFO contact experience. But This one is very, very different, and the paintings make it so haunting.
Yes. Yeah, totally. And I asked him why he didn't like that title, and he said, one, because it's sort of a reference to Christianity, just the idea of purgatory, which is something he's sort of staunchly not religious because of his upbringing and sort of extreme fundamentalism in Georgia, which he reacted against. And then two, he said it never felt like a purgatory because it was, you know, mostly a positive experience. But then again, he loved, you know, Farah and the book itself, just not the title.
That's totally fair. He's not the only, you know, author who's had that happen, publisher.
Right.
So, there's one image in the movie. I think he must be living in New York at this point. And I sent it to you, I'll describe it verbally. It's shown like basically his point of view from his bed. And it looks like there's a circular portal opening in the wall, and this tall woman crescent who looks like she has an absurd kind of page boy wig on, this black wig on this chalky white big-eyed woman. And she's kind of backlit by this image. And there's also a tall praying mantis in the scene and several small grays. And it is beautifully lit. There's just this soft, gentle yellowish white glow coming from this round circle. And that was another one that really struck me as, you know, hauntingly powerful.
Mm-hmm. Same with me. It's maybe my second favorite too.
Well, you're kidding. I'm batting 1,000 here.
Yeah. Yeah. And also I love how he captures that POV feeling too. And even though it's supposed to be his bed in his small New York apartment, you feel like you're in this totally other world. Yeah, and he said this was like almost a nightly occurrence, this sort of scene where he'd either sort of wake up, or it'd be before he went to bed, or in the middle of the night, he'd watch this portal open like an aperture, and they would come through, like just like that.
Now, if this happened every night, I mean, how to say this nicely, it should be expected that he would be somehow traumatized.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, every night, I think sometimes.
If it happened once, exactly. You would have permission to be traumatized. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And he does have when you meet him and you hear him, he does have this somewhat traumatized way of talking about it.
I agree. I agree.
Just because, regardless if he says it was a positive experience, this is not normal. And so that's why I think painting, the act of painting, was the way for him to sort of get these images and experiences out of his head, and his way of doing therapy and working through the trauma of these experiences. And he wouldn't, if you asked him, would you say these were traumatizing? He would say no, because I think to him that's a very extreme word. But I think it's hard to really agree with that.
You have trauma with, you know, all lowercase letters, let's say. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But part of the trauma too was his childhood wasn't great. He had abusive alcoholic parents and very unstable home life, you know, and experiencing that, you know, all your childhood, it's going to make a mark on anyone.
And he shared that with me.
Yeah.
That when we talked, yeah, he said it was time to go. And so him and I shared something very similar. He was 19 years old and moved to New York City, and I did the same thing. I did it in 1980. And so I know my childhood was wonderful. I lived in a perfectly idyllic, you know, suburb, kind of Leave It to Beaver childhood. But I will tell you that anyone moving to New York City at 19 is going to be blown away. And he talked a lot about that, how wonderful it was to be in that city. And
and not be the weirdo for once, you know.
As like, was I too. Yes, yeah, I was an art student and everything. Yeah, so.
Yeah, you can imagine, you know, when he told his parents in rural Georgia that he wanted to be an artist, they were not at all accepting or understanding about what that even meant.
Yes, and my parents were very cautious too. I don't think they had any way to. Well, yeah. So anyway, this isn't my story, but so well. As an art director, I'm going to say something very. I'm just going to have to. I am so glad you had those simple block letter titles. So they were very beautiful. I worked for a long time as an art director, mostly doing advertising stuff, and the little captions just were very nicely art directed. And once again, I'm going to go back. I'm going to thank you for treating me, the viewer, as a grown up. I need to compliment the subtleness of this film.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. It was all intended that way.
And there's one other subtle point there where there was a special effect that was, and I've seen it used in other documentaries, oftentimes with photographs, but there was, you would take his paintings and there was just a gentle kind of illusion of depth created by just a pan and how the foreground moved against the background. If it had been done any more, it would have been too much. It was perfect. So I'm complimenting you on that too, that you took these paintings, these oil paintings, oftentimes close-ups of these paintings, and just created an illusion of depth using some sort of computer effect. And I thought that worked great.
Thank you. Yeah. What we ended up doing is I had someone paint what's called a depth map for each painting, and it's sort of a grayscale representation of the depth in the painting, so foreground, midground, and background. And then when you plug that in After Effects, you can do just these really very subtle camera moves that it's just enough to give it interest without, you know, being too over the top or wonky seeming.
Oh, it worked beautifully. It worked beautifully. For me, the most powerful moment in the film, the most touching moment in the film, was the scene that took place in the deli there in Hoboken where David makes sandwiches. And there's this sort of montage of him talking to the people in the neighborhood and them saying, "Hi, David," and he'll say hello, and then he'll make a sandwich and they'll say thank you and he'll say you're welcome. I don't know what it was, but I mean, I'm almost like I'm getting little tingles on the back of my neck right now just talking about this. I thought that was so gentle and so perfect. I'm so glad that was so beautiful, that scene.
Yeah, and people, yeah, they love him, the ones that know him, and they have no idea about his experiences. They just know him as the guy that makes their sandwiches. And I didn't tell David I was coming in to film that day. It was sort of a surprise because I didn't want him to sort of be prepared or thinking about that. So it was all like totally genuine and his usual sort of friendly interactions.
And then there's you interviewed the guy who runs the sandwich shop, and he's this kind of, you know,
yeah,
Hoboken, the guy who runs the sandwich shop in Hoboken. That's exactly what he seemed like. And mm-hmm. he just was as gracious as he could be about David.
Yeah, yeah. He's, you know, the salt of the earth, like first generation Italian immigrant. And he was completely accepting. He's like, you know, he said he saw it. I believe he saw it. I haven't seen an astronaut or an alien, but I believe him. And that's, you know, that's all that matters.
There's one painting, and I don't know if you could talk about this, where I think he's still a boy. He's living in Georgia, and his house, it looked like a very modest house, was up on cinder blocks or up on little stilts. It was up off the ground. And he was on one side of the house, and he's kind of looking under the house, and there are all these legs seen with these matching blue coveralls. That image was scary for me.
Yeah, yeah. I was also imagining myself in that situation too. And it's also just such a good detail. Like, it's just, in my mind, it's not something one makes up, seeing these legs under the house like that. It really does seem like a memory as he's experienced something.
And that he's and it's, you sense that he, like, I don't think he can't help himself but to purge himself of these, I mean, not purge, but maybe wrestle with his demons in a way through the act of painting.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
How has David been doing after the movie?
It's been good for him, actually. He's never really had anyone to talk to about this or talk with about this. He's not really met many people that know about his story. And so for him to, like, you'll see in that one scene in the film at the end, which is the gallery show of his work, that was like a a very positive experience for him because it was his first solo show. It was in New York City, and he got to meet all these people that were there to see his work, and it was a fairly young crowd too. Again, not the usual type of people he interacts with, and everyone was very positive and non-judgmental about the work, and you could just see he was like beaming, you know, ear to ear smile. Everyone asking him questions, like he's the man of the hour. That, and plus he made it to a couple of the festival screenings, a big show they had of his in Philadelphia. And so it's, you know, at 75, the first time your work really being seen, your story being taken seriously, I think it's been, you know, really good for him. Otherwise it would be total obscurity for the most part, which I think he would still have been okay with. He's very private, but, on the flip side, he's a very private person. He's introverted, and all the attention, you know, people have found out his phone number. They'll come sort of confront him at the deli, and that's gotten to be a bit much. And he's sort of asked to not, really make appearances anymore because of that. And he's had a few people, say some disparaging thing. Like he's been invited on a podcast where they basically like just laughed at his story and him, which was horrible. So it's good and bad, but I think mostly good.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Hey, we have reached the 30-minute mark, and this is the time we're going to say goodbye to the free Dreamlanders. And for the paying Dreamlanders, for the members, we're going to jump right in and conclude this interview for the next half hour. So stay tuned.
You've probably heard the music for years. It's the theme song for Dreamland. But you may not know the name of the piece, The O of Pleasure. Or the name of the composer, Ray Lynch. Ray Lynch is a 3-time Billboard Award winner. Ray is also the composer of the platinum album, Deep Breakfast. Pandora calls Ray one of the most influential artists in New Age pop and adult alternative circles. For music that will move your heart and set your spirit soaring, visit www.raylynch.com.
War Day changed the way we think about nuclear war. Communion led millions to realize that they had encountered the visitors. Superstorm gave a word to the world that has become the byword of our time. The Key is among the most prophetic books ever written. And where can you get inside the mind that created all this? On unknowncountry.com, where Whitley's life stories, his powerful meditations, his books, Communion, Transformation, The Secret School, and others are available in audio format. And so much more exclusive Whitley Strieber material. Join Whitley on the path to tomorrow. How? Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today.
Welcome back to The Unseen. We are here with Brad Abrahams, and we're talking about his documentary from 2017, Love and Saucers. Just before the break, we talked about the gallery show that was put on for David Huggins, who is the subject of this documentary. And yes, I agree. It was very lovely. There's a scene where he's driving home in the car. It looks like you're in a taxi and you're taking him back to Hoboken and the camera's there in the car. And he was just as, in his very soft-spoken way, he said something to the effect of, what a nice night.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And he, what's also interesting is that David actually he's a hard person to interview because he's so sort of short with his words. He's not a big talker. A lot of one word answers, and you have to really sort of pull things out of him. And so I wanted more of a reaction about the night for him. And he was like, no, you know, it was just good. I really enjoyed it. That's it.
Oh, and having, and knowing him, I would have expected nothing less. Yes. And he was just content and smiling. That's very lovely. I heard from another interview that you did shortly after the documentary came out with a friend of mine named Ryan Sprague on his podcast Somewhere in the Skies. And you said that David got back to you and that he heard from his friends, and I think, I don't know how it came out, but did, like, they gave their approval? Is that right?
Yeah. So this was before David had even seen the movie. Yeah. He called me and said, "Brad, I just wanted you to know, I had an encounter, or like sort of like a dream encounter with the beings, and they said they approved of the documentary." And I don't know quite how to take that in, but I was happy because the last thing I want would be to piss off a group of extraterrestrials and start having them visit me in unpleasant ways. So I'm happy they enjoyed it.
Good. Well, okay, I'm going to take a couple steps back. Uh-huh. So I have, here, I'll just tell a story here. I have spoken with Barbara Lamb. She's a hypnotherapist who does abduction research, and she's in California. She's a wonderful, sweet, charming lady. And she told a story about, I think I'm doing this correctly, she had finished a book, and she was walking through her living room, just from one end of the house, and then she walked through it again, and then it was full daylight, and there was a giant reptilian being, a giant reptile standing in her living room. And she says, she's very funny. She's a hypnotherapist, so she talks in her hypnosis voice a lot, or she has this kind of soft voice. And she said, "I'm the kind of person who wouldn't like a reptile, right? I don't like snakes or lizards, but I walked right up to this giant reptile and I held his hands. And I asked him, why aren't I afraid of you?" And I think the giant reptile telepathically said something to the effect of like, "Oh, I have been bred specifically so I won't frighten you." And then the next thing she knows, she's standing in the living room. She's all alone and it's nighttime out. So it went from day to night, like click, just in an instant. So she lost a number of hours. She later went through hypnotherapy. Yes, hypnotherapy is a messy, controversial subject. But under hypnosis, she told of being taken aboard a craft, and they basically, the beings basically said, "We want to thank you so much. We approve of your book." So when I heard that story, you sharing that story earlier, my initial thought was like, "Oh, I've heard that before, that the beings will come back and will say they'll thank people basically for doing these books."
Yeah. And I think especially was interesting just because David hadn't seen it yet. So it wasn't like it was his approval.
Very interesting. And David has since seen it, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So I believe, so he, you can see in the film, he is a VHS kind of guy. He has like a collection of 2000 VHS tapes and only really watches things on VHS. And so I was trying to actually get a copy of the movie made onto VHS for him, but it's very difficult now. So I think the first time he saw it was at a festival that was nearby, seeing it on the big screen. And he really enjoyed it. He didn't have anything bad to say, no corrections, nothing. And, you know, there's some somewhat controversial stuff and sensitive stuff with his ex-wife and everything, but he did not have any issues whatsoever.
And my understanding is he's on good terms with his ex-wife, and she even, I mean, doesn't he own a building, a whole building? Is that his?
Yeah, so it's a very sort of rare living situation, not one I've heard of before, where, you know, he's been divorced for 20 years or more, almost 30 years now, with his ex-wife, and yet they still live together. So I think they separated for a little, then they realize, you know, they still like each other, just non-romantically, and so they just live on different levels of the house. And I think together they own this old house in Hoboken, like this very skinny three-story plus basement house, and on very amicable terms. Like I watch them together and they're super friendly. And yeah, it's odd, but it works for them.
Okay, I'm going to take another half a step back. There is this sense that there's within the UFO lore, there's a sense, there's no way to prove this, obviously, that certain books, certain events are somehow staged or somehow orchestrated or somehow brought onto the to our stage, let's say, for a purpose. I can't speak for Whitley, but I would say that his, the cover, if nothing else, the cover of the book Communion felt in some way staged, because that proved to be such a trigger for people. Mm-hmm. I've heard that so many times, people saying, like, I saw the cover of Communion and all these memories came flooding back. Or like, I dropped my groceries in the grocery store when I saw it on the paperback shelf. So I would say, this is one way to look at it, I'm being very cautious, I'm choosing my words carefully, that the cover of Communion felt like it was staged by an outside source. What's your sense of you meeting David? I mean, this is a beautiful movie about an experience that crosses over into other realms. I mean, do you feel like this was at all? I mean, how did it fall together? Let me put it that way, the actual production of the movie.
Yeah, so originally I heard a little bit about David's story for the first time. I think it was like 2011. And it was on, I can't even remember what was a podcast, and they just very sort of offhandedly mentioned him as something ridiculous. So it was like too ridiculous even for these like UFO people to even discuss. So that really sort of caught my attention as someone who likes weird things. So I started trying to do research on him, and there was almost nothing on the internet about him at the time, except for Farah's book, which I bought, saw the images, was totally transfixed. I contacted her and she gave me his home phone number. I sort of cold called David out of the blue and just said, "Hey David, I'm a filmmaker. I'd love to do some kind of story with you. I don't know what yet, but I just want to know if you'd be interested or game for something." And he, you know, there was a pause and he said, "You know, Brad, I think it's time." And so that started a series of very long calls with him, like hours long, where I would sort of record them and make notes. And then eventually I visited him as sort of an experiment, filmed for a couple days, made a little short out of it. And that got interest for a few years down the line to make this into a feature.
And excuse me, was that the teaser short that I would have seen?
Yes.
It had the soundtrack. It was, Nature Boy by Nat King Cole?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Of course, I couldn't use that in the actual film because of I can't get the rights to something like that. But that was sort of the teaser that I made when I stayed at his house. I slept over for a weekend and filmed with him. And I sort of sat on the footage for a while and eventually was like, I've got to make something out of this, try and get some interest in it. Really, like, so I made that little 2-minute teaser and it really sort of exploded online at the time, got like hundreds of thousands of views. And I was like, oh, people, you know, are actually interested and want to see something like this, like sort of to my surprise. So I got interest enough to help me make it into a short sort of feature length film. It's like almost 70 minutes. Yeah. And then the rest is history.
So this is a year and a half ago. And what I have seen in a year and a half in your movie would be one of them. And then since then, there's been a handful. I think they just made some money. And I think people were willing to put up money to make a feature length documentary about the UFO lore. I think they were popular. And I'm seeing more and more of these in Jeremy Corbell's films, I think, sort of fall into that too. And so, I mean, you were right at the front of that wave.
Yeah, and so one thing that's tying all those films together is this distribution company called The Orchard, and not so much anymore, but at the time, one of their acquisitions people, he's a big sort of UFO phenomena fan, so he was sort of gobbling up these films if they seemed good, and distributing them so the masses could see them. So I think that was part of how they made it into the zeitgeist a few years ago too.
Well, it's real. I think it's really happening. I mean, I sense it. Yeah. I mean, just as there it is, like it's on the crawl there on Netflix between, you know, like, you know, so what was impressive for me was to see this movie on the iTunes crawl, you know, right between some comedian and some TV show. You know, there it was, this person who's had very powerful UFO contact experiences. iTunes is as mainstream as it gets.
Yeah. Yeah. And as well, seeing Jeremy Corbell's films on Netflix and Unacknowledged on Netflix, it's weird, definitely, to be seeing that. But it's also now commonplace for, you know, UFO stories to be front page New York Times.
Yes, we've jumped into that new era there. Yeah. And I have some very strong opinions on that, too. I think that there's real news coming out. I just think the puppet masters are feeding that news very cautiously, which is understandable. But yes, there was just within the last couple of weeks, Stanton Friedman died. And I had the chance to meet him a couple times. And I heard him interviewed shortly after. This is a total aside here. I had a chance to listen to him shortly after the 2017, which was right around the same time as your film. December 2017 was when the, you know, like a very level-headed article came out in the New York Times, and it talked about these sightings within the Navy as well as the secret program within the Pentagon. Now, Stanton Friedman commented on that. I can't remember, but I heard him on a podcast, and he said, very wisely, he said, somewhere someone flipped a switch. And I would have loved to have been in that room and heard the conversation when that decision was made to flip that switch. And I agree with that. I think that it didn't happen by accident that this ended up in the New York Times.
No. No, I don't think it's all to do with just because, you know, Luis Elizondo decided it was time.
Yes, that's a great story, this maverick, mm-hmm. you know, guy. But I think it's a little more nuanced than that. And I would also say that, so these two things are happening at once. Your movie is coming out. Or your movie came out in a very dry way, you know, a sensationalistic subject treated unsensationalistically. I think I said that right. And others have followed. And I guess the New York Times articles feel the same way. It's a sensationalistic subject treated very level-headedly. And this is for me, who's had these kind of experiences and sort of, you know, like I've sort of given up trying to convince the mainstream to take any of this seriously. I just put my stuff out in these little books and in a blog and stuff like that. But I find that this is, the tides are changing, and your movie is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. I do think though, it's two different things in a way, because all the more mainstream coverage that's coming out is UFO sightings. And they have not leaped to abduction phenomena yet, which is, that's a whole other sort of step and subject than just acknowledging that there are strange things in the sky to them, and they also have beings from another planet, and they're, you know, landing and taking people and doing weird things to them.
Here's a question for you. What's your personal experiences? Why are you drawn to this subject?
Yeah, I haven't had any, you know, supernatural or unexplainable experiences. I'm just drawn to it from what it tells us about ourselves, or what it can tell us about ourselves, about consciousness, you know, our place in the universe. All of that is what draws me to it. And that it's the fringes of experience that tell us the most about ourselves, but it's the fringes that get ignored, and not taken seriously. So that's my motivation for trying to tell a story like this.
Well, thank you. And I would also say that, yes, the fringes get ignored, but they also seep in to the popular consciousness. Yeah. So I have a feeling everyone has a probably incorrect idea of what UFO contact means, right? I mean, you could just go to a shopping mall and ask people randomly, like, oh, how would you define UFO abduction? And I bet you would get a pretty sophisticated answer from most people, because it's out there. It's part of the consciousness. And yes, To the Stars Academy ain't touching the UFO contact thing as yet. Who knows what the future will bring? But right, but yes, so that was always the question about disclosure, you know, like, well, what if the president stands on the podium and you know, says, you know, we're not alone in the universe. And the first person who raises his hand at the press conference says, what about all those people who say they've been abducted from their bedrooms?
Uh-huh.
You know, you know, I don't think the president would want to answer that question.
Exactly. So, yeah.
The music in this film. Oh, there was so, it wasn't even music at all. I almost would be shy to call it music. It was just almost this, like, this vibrational, gentle tone that just kind of rung through the whole story.
Yeah, you can call it more like sound design. And I worked with this guy in the Netherlands, and he's like a electronic musician. And he also lectures about world building at university in the Netherlands. And so he has this like sort of great grasp at how both sound and vision can create worlds and sort of immerse you into a new place. And he used that, I think, to great effect in a subtle way to get people into each of these scenes through this sort of otherworldly sound design that permeates throughout it.
It was very effective. It was very effective. It was not overpowering. It was very subtle. And so was the editing complete and he created the soundtrack to match the visuals?
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So very nicely done. It was very beautiful.
Thank you.
At one point in the film, David tells a story. He was in New York, a young man in New York, and it's done through a series of several paintings. And a car pulls up. There was a transit strike or something, and it was raining. And this car pulls up and gives him a ride. Very eerie. The lady in the car. There's close-ups of these paintings, and then he has a dream that night. And afterwards, after this dream, this very powerful dream, he bought flowers for Crescent, and basically said, "If you're real, I'm going to buy you flowers." Am I getting this story correctly?
Yeah. For the most part, yeah.
So. There's this wonderful scene. He's smiling. He's sitting there in his studio and he's a little bit embarrassed. And he kind of says, I cleaned up my apartment. I cleaned it up like I was excited for a date. And I thought it was just such a haunting detail to him to say that. And then the next morning he woke up fully expecting he would have an encounter that night. The next morning he woke up and the flowers were gone.
Yeah.
And there was an accompanying set of paintings for that.
Yeah.
That was, very, to be told through paintings, that was very beautiful.
It was those details, like him being sort of embarrassed and thinking like he was going to have a date with something or someone from another dimension or solar system. It was funny and it was disarming and like sort of cute. And one of also the few experiences that sort of spilled into sort of more objectively into the real world.
Because the flowers were gone the next day.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now for you, what's your favorite part of the movie? Let me put it that way. That's a simple question.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I may just be at the very end, the gallery show sort of tying it all up with him. It's sort of the whole film, with the exception of him in the deli, is just him in his house and mostly in his studio or in his room. And it's very claustrophobic. And that's sort of the impression I get of his life, too. Like he spends most of his time up there and most of his time inside. And so to finally just sort of like break out of that Hoboken house world into a place with a lot of people and him in the middle of it all felt really nice. And again, I think was also like really good for him.
And that was staged in a way by, didn't you generate that or put that together?
Yeah. We rented the gallery space. It's sort of a gallery known for rotating shows. And so we just rented it for the night, put up the paintings and sent out some emails, like a Facebook ad and things like that. And just hoped people would show up. And a lot of people did. Like, it was a really good turnout. We had people who were just sort of walking by, come in off the street, friends of friends. Some of David's friends came. It turned out really well. It would have been very difficult to have that happen organically just because no one really knew of David enough to actually offer to have an art show for him.
And how did you get Jeff Kripal, and how did he show up in the film?
Yeah, so I was sort of searching for some kind of outside voice. At first, I wanted that voice to be David's wife, but she did not want to be involved in the film. And I didn't want to get sort of an outright skeptic that didn't know David, because the whole point is you have to know him to have any kind of opinion on it. If you don't take him as a person into consideration, then it's sort of meaningless commentary, I think. And so I wasn't just going to get some random psychiatrist or what have you to comment on it. So I found, just through searching, I found Jeff, and he has such a unique point of view and comes from such a unique place to comment on the UFO phenomena. And he's both sympathetic, but also academic and skeptical. And he turned out to be the perfect person for this outside voice. And he had several conversations with David by phone. So I could make sure they sort of got to know each other. And I really appreciated his point of view. I think it makes sense. And not many other people are talking about abduction experience like he is, which for people that don't know, it's that these types of experiences have been happening to humans for thousands of years. They just haven't been called alien abduction. You know, at first it was mystical experiences. Then it was religious experiences, and now it's UFO experiences, and that the content of these unexplainable things changes over time to the context of the era that we're in. And it makes a lot of sense. It still is not saying what the experiences are, just that it's not a new thing. And it's a very human experience.
And I will also add that I know Jeff and I've read much of his work, and he is the core of his study, in a way, is the eroticism mm-hmm. of these experiences, you know, whether they be Christian experiences or Eastern experiences. And this is something that doesn't get talked about often. You go to a UFO conference and whatever, you're on your second glass of wine at the bar and you're going to hear some stories. Jeff Kripal is one of my heroes in this realm. And I had no idea he was going to show up on the screen. All of a sudden, there he is. And he was the perfect person to, and he did play a little bit of the therapist in a way by sort of pointing out that the wall of horror movies, you know, is his way of like working through his demons in a way.
Mm-hmm. And he brought up the conundrum that is, is it this sort of in the 50s, this wave of science fiction and alien focused films, is that what sort of was the seed for everyone's imagery of alien abductions, or were people's images of alien abductions the seed for all these movies and books that came out at the time? And for him, it's a bit of both. It's not a either or, it's sort of a cycle that feeds into itself.
I think there was a conversation, I'm paraphrasing, I'm going to do this poorly, but there was a conversation, I think it was between Jeff Kripal and Whitley Strieber, who went on to write a book together called The Supernatural. And do you have that book?
I don't have it, but I know about it.
Oh, you should. Yes.
I want to read it.
And I think it was before this that Jeff Kripal brings up exactly that example, basically saying that, you know, our science fiction has shaped our comprehension of the visitor experience. And, you know, what can we do about that? And without skipping a beat, Whitley Strieber said, we need to make better science fiction movies.
Oh, so great.
Which was a great answer. So yes. And I would take that one step further. It's like, there are a handful, count them on the fingers of one hand, like very level-headed, thoughtful documentaries about the UFO contact experiences. Yours is one of them. I would follow that up. We need more films like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm saying it from a perfectly selfish point of view because of my own experiences. And like, I want this story to be told in a thoughtful, I use the term, first words out of my mouth when I started this interview, compassionate. I want a thoughtful, compassionate. I keep on going back to the word story, right? I mean, stories need to be told. I want the story of these experiences to be thoughtful and compassionate. even though they might be fraught with fears and unanswerable questions. But I would like to see the overall story be turned into something a little more gentle and a little more compassionate than the late night cable TV, you know, exploitation documentaries that defined the last 25 years.
There's that. And then I think there's also, you know, the interview or the documentary filmmakers themselves being maybe too close to the subject matter sometimes too. And if there isn't, you know, some level of objectivity and impartiality, then it's never really going to be taken seriously if you're just, you know, sort of a fanboy or fangirl for the subject that you're making a movie on.
Or if you're an experiencer yourself, you know.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Yeah. So a few projects in the pipeline. One is a feature length documentary on cryptozoologists. So on the people that actually go and study these hidden and unknown animals. So it's not necessarily like the usual, which is like a film about a certain monster or about trying to find Bigfoot. It's about sort of these character studies of the people that actually devote their lives to the study of these creatures. So that's one. I have a sort of science documentary that's been in the works for a while that's going to be released episodically. I'm working on a narrative, like fiction project, like a fun short film that's a dark comedy horror film about conspiracy theories. And then the newest thing in the works is a potential series on folklore, some bizarre folklore from around the world.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, so a lot going on. And then in the middle of all that, you know, trying to make a living with actual paying work.
I've given up on that at this point.
Yeah. So,
hey, thanks so much. This has been a delight. Now, if folks want to get a hold of you or watch the film, what do they do?
Two things. For the film, they can go to loveandsaucers.com, and that links all the different ways you can see it. If you're an Amazon Prime member, it's free. That's the easiest way to watch it. And then if you want to see my other work, it's just my name, bradabrahams.net.
Thank you so much. This has been a delight.
Yeah, thank you too. Enjoyed it.
Hey, this is Mike. I am chiming in at the end here after the editing. I'm going to point out something. Brad is Canadian, and I grew up on the Canadian border. I'm living on the Canadian border right now. Canadians are really wonderful, gentle people. I'm simplifying this greatly. And this is a wonderful, gentle movie, and I can't help but think, I talked about this privately with Brad, and we laughed a little bit when I said as much, and I feel it's true, but this is a sort of Canadian movie, right? It's a movie about a gentle, soft-spoken guy, and it's just, the subject is so strange and so unsettling, but the movie itself is so gentle and pleasant, so yes. Thank you, Canada, and thank you, Brad. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.